All you brave souls who have pulled yourselves away from the television sets and hero sandwiches and everything else. We're very pleased that you're here. We're very pleased to introduce Dr. Ziegler, who holds a PhD in Bible from Bar-Ilan, teaches at Matan and Herzog. Rumors are that she's the best teacher Matan's ever had. Her book, Promises to Keep, analyzes the role of the oath in biblical narrative as a literary device. She's a very popular teacher. She lives in Alon Shavut with her husband and five children. We thank the sponsors of the evening, the Wallman family, the Pine Orenstein, and the Levin family. And we give you Dr. Ziegler.
Erev Tov, good evening. I'd like to thank David Jacobowitz for arranging this evening, and those of you who actually came out despite the exciting events that seem to be going on in the background. It's wonderful to be here in Teaneck, and it's wonderful to see some familiar faces, both from the old country and some former students as well. In tonight's year, I'd like to talk about a literary phenomenon that exists in the Tanakh, and that is the phenomenon of type scenes. Oftentimes we have what's called a type scene in Tanakh. Now, in general, when we talk about literary methods and applying literary methods to Tanakh, we are often looking for criteria that indicates that those literary methods are actually correct when we apply them to the Tanakh, that it's actually something which is compelling. And in tonight's year, I want to show you how this literary methodology, which is used in all literature, can be used to not just to apply it to Tanakh learning, but to mine the biblical narratives for their deeper theological message. In other words, ultimately, to use a literary technique is not in and of itself what's important. When we learn Tanakh in order to find the deeper messages. And that's really what I want to show you tonight. As a side benefit to tonight's shiur, I also want to perhaps deepen a little bit our understanding of this week's parsha. We are a little bit going to be talking as part of this shiur about Parsha Yitro. Now, in terms of type scenes, what is a type scene? A type scene is some sort of scene or scenario in Tanakh which occurs several times, and where therefore we have certain expectations from that scene. So, for example, I'll give you an example that probably everybody's familiar with. There's a type scene in which a man goes to a foreign country, and he is, of course, afraid that his wife is going to be taken as a captive because she's very beautiful, and that he will subsequently be killed. And therefore, he says to his wife, please say that you are my sister so that I will not be killed because of you. And she, of course, says that she's his sister. The foreign king, who becomes actually very enamored of this woman and takes her to his palace, then discovers that she is in fact married, whereupon he calls upon the man and he chastises him and says, why did you tell me that she was your sister? At which point he unceremoniously expels the man from his country along with gifts. Okay, now this scene takes place three different times, right? We have it in Bereishit Perek Yud Bet with Avraham in Mitzrayim. We have it in Bereishit Kaf with Avraham in Grar. And then we have it once again in Bereishit chapter 26, this time with Yitzchak. Now what we do with these type scenes, and there are really many, many different types of type scenes in Tanakh. I'll just give you another example. The barren woman type scene, right? I mean, they all share certain features. And what we do with these type scenes is, first of all, we want to isolate what is common about all of these scenes. In other words, what are my expectations when I come upon this scene? What features do they all share together? Perhaps we also want to ask ourselves, what is symbolic about those features? And why do we have those features as part of that particular scene? What is the goal of the scene? And at the same time, and I think this is perhaps even more critical, what we want to ask ourselves is, what is different about this particular scene? And how does that jump out at me so that then I see something unique about that story, right? So, I mean, perhaps if we take a sort of a prosaic example, if we would look at any fairy tale where we are very familiar with what is about to unfold. And if one of the components of that story, one of the elements of that story were to change, we would all sit up and take notice, right? You tell the story about a young girl who went to visit her grandmother, and she walks through the forest and she's picking flowers, and along comes a lion and scares her. And everyone jumps up and says, not a lion, a wolf, right? Because we know that we're expecting a wolf. Well, the same sort of effect the type scene has, because as soon as one feature diverges from our expectations, we immediately sit up and take notice, whether we are conscious of that fact or not. And so I want to bring to your attention a type scene that I think we are very familiar with. I think that one point that I always like to make when we talk about literary techniques, sometimes people object. They say, well, this is a modern concept. How could you apply some sort of modern technique to Tanakh learning? And my response is always, there's nothing modern whatsoever about it, except perhaps the name. Because Chazal are deeply aware of type scenes, as they're deeply aware of key words and key phrases, as they are of most of the literary techniques that today we have all sorts of fancy names for them, but Chazal utilized them very, very frequently in their study of Tanakh. And so we're often going to find some of these phenomena in the Midrashim. For example, I think the type scene that I want to talk about today, which is of course the scene in which a man travels to a distant land. He is in search of a wife. He arrives at a well. There he meets a na'ara, right, a young girl, who happens to be, coincidentally, from his family. She invites him to her house, where she provides him with a meal, and they are betrothed. This is a very common type scene. How many times does it appear in Tanakh? Off the top of your head? Three. We all think three. And that's what Chazal say also. Right? Chazal are very familiar with this type scene. We have a midrash in Shmot Rabbah in which we're told the reason that Moshe in chapter 2 of Sefer Shmot of the book of Exodus, the reason that Moshe went to the Be'er is because he understood that if he would go to a well, then he's likely to find his future wife, because he already saw that both Yitzchak and Yaakov have type scenes next to a well, and that's the reason that he went to the well. That, even though Chazal never call it a type scene, that is Chazal's recognition that we have a type scene. And not only are they aware of the type scene, but they actually suggest that Moshe as well was aware of the type scene. Anyone who's interested in reading more about this literary phenomenon, I would very much recommend Robert Alter's book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, where in general, I mean, it's a very accessible book, it's a very easy book, it's probably one of the first books to examine the role of applying literary techniques and literary methodology to learning Tanakh. In chapter 3 of that book, and it is an academic book, but it's actually a very accessible academic book, in chapter 3 he actually does describe type scenes, and he talks about this one as one of the paradigms of the type scenes in Tanakh. I'm going to take some of his ideas in a little bit of a different direction. But for those of you who want to further your knowledge on this issue, that's really a good place to start. What Alter does, actually, is suggest that we don't have three occasions of this well scene in Tanakh. We actually have five, right? There's no doubt that Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Moshe are type scenes, but he's going to add two. And as we progress through the shiur, I'm going to show you those two that he adds. One other thing that I'll mention, and that is that Chazal also add one of Alter's. Okay, one of the two that Alter suggests is also a type scene. We're going to find in the Midrashim as well. But let's move on and actually see what it is that we can do with this type scene. So the first thing that, of course, we wanted to do is to isolate some of the features of the type scene, which we've already done. Right, the well, the na'ara, inviting to a meal. They're from the same family. These are all our expectations from the type scene. We also might want to talk a little bit about what is the goal of the type scene. Who gets a betrothal scene in Tanakh, right? Not everybody gets a birth story, and not everybody gets a betrothal scene. Whoever gets a betrothal scene obviously has some sort of legacy that they are seeking to perpetuate, that they're seeking to continue through their children. Okay, this seems to be the underlying idea of the type scene itself. We see a whole elaborate story in which we watch a man who has some sort of legacy that he's looking to perpetuate, go and look for the appropriate person to partner him in the perpetuation of his legacy. Okay, so those are that's who we're looking for. Let's begin with the type scene of Yitzchak and Rivka. And this type scene, of course, takes place in Bereishit Perakaf Dalid. And in Bereishit Perakaf Dalid, what we have is the traveling of whom to find a wife? Okay, Eved Avraham. Let's call him what the Tanakh calls him. I'm, of course, aware that the Midrash and Rashi as well call him Eliezer. But interestingly, never in chapter 24 in Sefer Bereishit is he ever called Eliezer. I only know he's Eliezer because Rashi tells me he's Eliezer. So I want to be careful and call him what the Tanakh calls him, because I think there's a very important reason that he's not called Eliezer. He doesn't function there as an independent person with an independent name. He rather functions as the long arm of Avraham, right? And therefore he's called servant of Avraham, which really leads me, I think, to the most important deviation in this particular type scene, which is, of course, that Yitzchak doesn't go, right? That's a deviation. In all the other type scenes, it's the husband himself who goes. A man travels to a distant land. He arrives at a well. He meets a Nahara next to that well. She invites him to her house, to a meal, and they are betrothed. Every feature, every component in the scene is present, except for the fact that it's not Yitzchak. Right, this, I think, is really the most striking deviation. And in my mind, Yitzchak's absence from the narrative is not merely a technicality. It is a key to understanding the entire narrative, and more specifically, the reason that we are perpetuating Yitzchak. And here I want to try to explain what I mean by that. Yitzchak is the second generation, right? What do we know about Yitzchak? I think we know one very important thing about Yitzchak, and that is that we know very little about Yitzchak. Right? That's the important thing that we know about him. Of course, we have 10 chapters that describe Avraham. 12 chapters describing Yaakov. I'm talking about their life, all of their different journeys, all of their different experiences. How many chapters actually focus on the life of Yitzchak? One, okay? One chapter, and that is chapter 26. And I want you to look in chapter 26. I hope that you have Tanakh. In chapter 26, which is, again, the one chapter in which Yitzchak is featured, and this is his own independent chapter, what we see throughout the chapter, of course, is that he is described over and over and over relative to Avraham. What is most striking in this chapter is how many times Avraham is mentioned as the background of Yitzchak's chapter. Look, for example, in Perek Kavav, chapter 26, verse 1, Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz, and there was a famine in the land. Milvad ha'ra'av harishon asher haya b'mei Avraham. That's aside from the first famine that was during the time of Avraham. Oh, I mean, that seems to be somewhat superfluous. Vayelech Yitzchak el Avimelech melech plishtim grara. He also, like Avraham, goes to Avimelech, the king of the plishtim, to grar. Look in Pasuk Gimel. I'm just going to give you a sense of it. We're not going to read through the whole parak. God says to Yitzchak, Gor ba'aretz hazot, live in this land, v'ayet imcha v'avarcheka. I'll be with you, and I'm going to bless you. Ki lecha ulizaracha aten et kol ha'aretzot ha'el. To you and to your seed, I will give all of these lands. V'akimoti et ha'shvu'a asher nishbati la'avram avicha. I'm going to keep my oath that I swore to your father. Look in the next pasuk. V'yirbeiti et zaracha kechochvei ha'shamayim v'natati lizaracha kol ha'aretzot ha'el. V'yitbarchu bizaracha kol goyei ha'aretz. Ekev asher shama Avraham bekoli. I don't even have to translate it, right? I'm going to give you all these great things. Why? Because Avraham listened to me. But you're speaking to Yitzchak, right? Avraham is the background of Yitzchak's life. It gets even, I think, more extreme. As we progress through the chapter, we see two very, very striking things. One is that Yitzchak steps very gingerly into his father's footsteps in the sense that he is an imitator of his father. Everything Yitzchak does is something that Avraham did before him, including the famine, including the wife-sister story, including the covenant that he's going to make with Avimelech, etc., etc., etc. The one thing that he does that does seem to be innovative, I want you to see this in Pasuk Tetvav. Look in Pasuk Tetvav in verse 15 in chapter 26. V'chol ha-be'erot asher chafru avdei aviv. all of the wells that the servants of his father had dug, Bimei Avraham Aviv, in the days of Avraham his father, Sitmum Plishtim Veimalum Afar. Right? The Plishtim had filled up these wells with dirt. And look in Pasuk Yudchet, skip ahead a little bit. Vayashov Yitzchak, and Yitzchak returned. Vayachpored Beirot Hamayim Asher Chafru Bimei Avraham Aviv. He redug those wells that were dug during the time of Avraham his father. Vayikra Lahem Shemot, and he called them names. Seems to be innovative. Kashemot Asher Kara Lahem Aviv. Like the same names that his father had called them. I skipped even the words, Acharemot Avraham. I think the point is really starting to emerge loudly and clearly. What we have is someone who is very much overshadowed by the looming, towering figure of Avraham. Lest you think that I say this as a critical point, that is not at all my objective here. That's not my aim. What I'm suggesting is actually something very positive. Avraham, the Midrash likens him to a har, to a mountain, right? The symbol of Avraham is this, as I mentioned, towering, looming figure. He can be seen from far away, and more than that, he sees very far. Avraham is the ultimate visionary, right? He is the one who's always described vayar, vayashkef, right? He is seeing, he is looking, he is gazing. Avraham sees, he has a vision. He is exactly that. He's a visionary. He's the forger of new paths. What happens in the next generation? We don't want a forger of new paths. We don't want a visionary. We want someone blind. That's really what we want. We want someone who can't see. Because if a visionary is followed by the visionary, then the vision is changed, right? And so we are looking for someone very different. And that's why Chazal say, what is the symbol of Yitzchak? Does anybody know? A sadeh, right? A field. It's the continuation of Abraham's legacy. And so Yitzchak is very careful to step into the huge footsteps that have already been created by Avraham. We see this both in chapter 26 and in the beginning of Parshat Toldot. Think of the first words of Parshat Toldot. Eile Toldot Yitzchak ben Avraham. These are the generations of Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. What should be the continuation? Yaakov, Esav. That's not the continuation. The continuation is Avraham, holid at Yitzchak. These are the generations of Yitzchak ben Avraham. Avraham gave birth to him. What's his legacy? What does he leave behind in the world? His ability to mirror his father. And note that the pasuk is filled with mirroring, right? Yitzchak ben Avraham. Avraham olid Yitzchak, right? There's a sense that his world is really encompassed by his ability. His legacy is about his ability to mirror his father, to continue his vision faithfully, and I think successfully. I think we live in a world in which we're all supposed to be forger of new paths and CEOs and creative. I don't think that the Tanakh means this at all as a critical point. Some people are meant to be leaders, and we need also to have people who are meant to be continuers. And that's what Yitzchak does. I'll say one more thing about this, and that is that another point that we are often pay attention to methodologically when we learn Tanakh are characters' first words and characters' last words. Oftentimes, first impressions, right? First impressions always matter. In the Tanakh also, when we're learning about characters, first impressions matter, right? And so when we meet Rachel and she, her first words out of her mouth are, Havali banim v'im ayin meita anochi, give me children, if not I'm dead. That's who Rachel is. That encapsulates Rachel's passion and who she is. When we meet Eliyahu, and his first words out of his mouth are, Chai Hashem asher amadti lifanav, im yev hashanim ha'ela ta'u matar ki'im lefi divari. I swear by God before whom I stand that there won't be any rain unless I say otherwise. That's Eliyahu. That's the biblical Eliyahu. That's not the rabbinic Eliyahu. But it encapsulates Eliyahu's harshness, his insistence on perfection. It's true about first words. Another thing that we try to pay attention to are last words. Because just as first impressions matter, so do last impressions. Now I'll tell you something interesting about Yitzchak. What's the first word out of his mouth? Avi. What's the last word out of his mouth? Avraham. Right, that's Yitzchak. His first word is Avi. His last word is Avraham. Yitzchak's legacy is not about himself. And so his betrothal scene is not about himself. It's about continuing Avraham. And that's why I insisted, it's not the only reason why, but it's one of the reasons why I insisted that we not call him Eliezer. Because I think the point that is made here is that we send Eved Avraham to betroth Yitzchak, because Yitzchak's marriage is about continuing Avraham's legacy. One other point I'll make here before we move on to our next type scene, but I'm just trying to also give you a sense of what it is that we're trying to do with the type scenes, is that it's very interesting that the Na'ara, who Yitzchak meets, or not Yitzchak, who Eved Avraham meets on behalf of Yitzchak at the well, is different than many of the other Na'arot, in that she is the one who brings the water. Right? That's not true about Yaakov. It's not true about Moshe. Right? And it's another difference in the scene. I would say one of the ideas, of course, is that we're looking for someone who does chesed. Right? That is what Eved Avraham says. Right? Hakreina lifanai hayom. Right? And he makes this whole test, which itself I think is a very intriguing component of the story. I'm not going to go in that direction for the present, because I do want to move on to the next narrative, but I am trying to also give you a sense of how much there is to do with this literary technique. But I do want to say one more thing about Rivka, and that is that her unusual activity in this story, I think, is also an important part in the story. Actually, I think we see four important things about Rivka in this story that are worthy of note. One is that she is the great Baalat Chesed, right? I mean, that's something every grade child knows. You know, you say to her, can I have some water for my camels, or can I have some water for myself? And she goes and she brings water for the camels. And of course, this is no small task. So she's a tremendous Baalat Chesed. Another thing that we see, her alacrity. She is very fast. There are many, many words that describe her rapid movements. Vatarot, vatimaher. That's point number two. Point number three, she's always looking. Okay? What do we see with her later at the end of the story? Well, at the end, very end of the story, perhaps I'll leave that aside for 1 second, and I'll just say the third thing first, because it happens in the wrong order. When she invites the Eved back to her house and they have a meal, so her father and her brother call her in to ask her if she wants to go with this servant all the way to a different country, probably never to see her family again, in order to marry this total stranger. Remember what she says? Eilech. Eilech. Right? The spontaneous leap into the unknown, right? That's the third thing. And the fourth thing that I would want to say about her is that when she does arrive in Eretz Yisrael and she sees Yitzchak out in the Sadeh, right? He is out, Lasuach Basadeh, he's conversing in the fields. Of course, Chazal say he's davening Mincha, right? And she sees him out there. He sees them coming. What does he see? Hine Gmalim Baim. He sees a bunch of camels. She looks up. She sees him. And she falls off the camel. Right, there's a clash of sight here. So what does she have? She has chesed, she has alacrity, she has the eilech, and she has sight. Who is she? She's Avraham, right? She's Avraham. The lech lecha meretzcha miladcha mibeit avicha. Avraham's always moving. Remember when the angels come to his house, vayimaher, vayarotz, vayimaher, right? He's the one who can see, and of course he is the great Baal Chesed. So there's something I think interesting that's going on here in this betrothal scene, because it's an attempt to continue Avraham on both sides. On the one hand, Yitzchak can't be Avraham, because then he would see something different. On the other hand, we have to make sure that Rivka is there in order to make sure that there's sight in the family, that the legacy is continued by the right son, right? Who's the one, obviously, who is the great supporter of Yaakov and not of Esav? That's Rivka, right? So there's a balance being created here where I think that the point of Yitzchak's marriage is about continuing Avraham's legacy. Okay, without furthering these ideas, and I think that, again, we could spend a lot of time talking just about this scene, but I want to move on to the next scene. The next scene, of course, is in Bereishit Perek Kaftet. And in this scene, we have the story of Yaakov. Yaakov's arrival in Haran. And, of course, there he meets a nara next to the well. This is, of course, Rachel. Now, let's refresh our memories. What are we expecting to find? A man journeys from his home to a distant land in order to find a wife. He finds a nara next to a well. She's from his family. She invites him to her home, gives him a meal, and they are betrothed. What's wrong here? What doesn't happen? What's different here? Well, first of all, this is no leisurely journey to find a wife. Indeed, there is that pretext that Yitzchak and Rivka, that Rivka says, "Katzti b'chayai," right? I need him to go marry somebody from my family. I don't want him to marry a Bat Kanan. But it's a pretext. Yaakov is running for his life. He's not going on some leisurely journey to find a wife. He is running from Esav, who is determined to kill him because he just took his bracha. Okay? So that's the first point that has to be made. What else? What else is different in this scene? Well, he meets the right nara next to the well, but it takes quite some time before he gets to marry her. And in the interim, not only does he have to work at hard labor for 7 years, but then he doesn't even get the right one, and he is, of course, deceived, has to work even harder, and then get his second wife. I could conclude, just on these two, just on the basis of these two deviations, that life is not very easy for Yaakov. But it gets worse. Yaakov doesn't get a meal, right? Nobody invites Yaakov for a meal. He's the only one that doesn't get invited for a meal, right? Which, again, is a deviation. It's only a deviation if we've noted that in all the other scenes, the prospective bridegroom is invited home for a meal. Yaakov is not invited home for a meal. And, of course, the last point that I think has to be made here is that there's something, a unique feature of this scene. What is the unique feature that appears only in the Yaakov story? What? Okay, yeah, but that I think is the common feature. In other words, I think that was the exception in the Eved Abraham and Rivka scene. It's always supposed to be the man who brings the water. I think there's, well, I won't go into in that direction. But I think that that the other very important feature of this scene is the stone. Right? This is a very unique feature. We don't have the stone on the well in any other scene. Of course, this itself, I think, relates to the other thing that we've been saying. Yaakov doesn't get the water easily, right? There is something massive that is blocking his access to the water. Now, this proves to be, in the end, no serious obstacle, because if we look in Pasuk Kaftet, of course, we were told this stone is insurmountable. One person can't do it alone. They have to wait until all the shepherds gather together, then they get the stone off the well. But look at what it says here in Pasuk Yud. Vayhi kasher ra'a Yaakov et Rachel bat Lavan achi imo ve'etzon Lavan achi imo vayigash Yaakov vayagel et ha'even me'al pia be'er. And it was when Yaakov saw Rachel and the sheep, and these are all belong to Lavan, the brother of his mother, and Yaakov approached and he rolls that stone from the mouth of the well, vayashk etzon Lavan achi imo. So Yaakov sees Rachel, somehow it gives him superhuman powers, and he's able to, all by himself, overcome the obstacle at the well. Again, I mean, I think it's the unique element in this story which proves to contain its central idea. Yaakov becomes the symbol of one who experiences adversity. And don't forget, Yaakov's life is marked by stones. There are many, many stones in Yaakov's life, right? He's always building matzevot, or some sort of structure with stones, both with Lavan, and when he makes the neder to God in the previous parak, and when he lies down and he takes me'avnei hamakom and he sleeps, right? These are all stories in which Yaakov somehow comes into contact with stones. I mean, I think that this is really a symbol of Yaakov's life. Yaakov is a man whose life is marked by stones. He contends with the hard, unyielding nature of life because nothing in life comes easy to him. Not his time in utero when he is struggling with his brother, not his birth when he is holding on to the heel of his brother. He struggles for the blessing, he struggles for the birthright, he struggles for his marriage, he struggles with his children. Yaakov's life is a life of adversity. But Yaakov becomes the symbol not just of a struggler, but I think perhaps much more importantly, he becomes the symbol of the one who prevails in his struggles. Right? And that is why God renames him Yisrael. Right? What does the pasuk tell us? Lo yamer od shimcha Yaakov ki im Yisrael ki sarita im Elokim v'im anashim vatuchal. You will no longer be called Yaakov, but Yisrael, for you have struggled with man and you have struggled with God and you have prevailed. And here I want to return to that Midrash that I referred to previously, in which Abraham's symbol was the mountain and Yitzchak's symbol was the sadeh, the field. And does anybody remember what Yaakov's symbol is in that same Midrash? The bayit. He is the house. Of course, Yaakov is the first one who builds the house. He builds a home, a strong, solid structure. He knows that he has to protect himself and his family. And Yaakov becomes the model of the one who summons up his supreme strength in order to overcome adversity in all areas of life, which is a model which, unfortunately, but it is the reality, proves efficacious for Am Yisrael throughout, I think, many generations, and certainly the upcoming period of exile, right, which we're reading about now in Sefer Shemot. So I think that these are some of the features that we see in Yaakov's story, which ultimately, I think, for us, really highlight for us and really lead us to the central idea of who Yaakov is. What is his legacy? This is the one who builds the house. This is the one who builds the walls. This is the one who teaches us how to prevail even in situations of adversity. Okay, let's move on to our parsha or our parshiot. And this is, of course, it's not actually in this week's parsha, but this week's parsha is Yitro, which is about Moshe's father-in-law. And here I want to draw your attention to Shmot Perek Bet. In Shmot Perek Bet, we have something similar. Let's look at it inside. Of course, here in this case, Moshe is in Egypt, and he has killed a Mitzri, which apparently has become common knowledge. Look in Pasuk Tedvav, I'm in chapter 2, verse 15, in Sefer Shmot. Vayishma paro et hadavar hazeh. Paro hears this thing, vayivakesh la'arog et Moshe. He wants to kill Moshe. Vayivrach Moshe mipnei faro. Vayeshev be'eretz Midyan. Vayeshev al habe'er. He goes to Midian and he sits next to the well. Ulechohen Midian, Sheva Banot. The Kohen of Midian has seven daughters. Vatavona, Vatidlena, Vatimalena et Aratim, Lashkot Tson Avihen. So they come and they draw the water. The water's drawn. They fill the troughs in order to bring their sheep to drink. Vayavo haroim vayigarshum, and the shepherds come along and they chase away, apparently, the sheep, right? Vayako Moshe vayoshian. Moshe comes and he saves them. Vayashket sonam, and he allows their sheep to drink. Vatavona el Reuel avihen, and they come to Reuel, their father. Vayomer, and he says, madua miharten bo hayom. Apparently this is a daily occurrence, because he says, how did you get home so quickly today? Vatomarna, and they said, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu Miyad Haroim. An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. Vigam Dalo Dalalanu. And he is drawn for us from the well. Vayashkitatzon. Vayomer Albinota Vayo. Where is he? Lama ze azav ten etaish? Kir ena lo vayochal lachem. Call him so he can eat bread. How could you have let him go? And what kind of business is this? Not to invite him for a meal. Don't you know the betrothal scene? Vayoel Moshe, Lashevet et Ha'ish. Moshe continues, or takes an oath, to stay with this man. Vayitain et Tzipora bito l'Moshe. Now, there's a lot to say about this scene. I could really speak for quite a long time about this scene, but I'm going to mention just a few points that I think really encapsulate what it is about Moshe's legacy that we are trying to continue here. One point, of course, is that Moshe also is not taking a leisurely walk to find a wife. It doesn't appear that he's looking for a wife at all. Moshe's looking for something very, very different, which we'll talk about in a minute. He's not looking for a wife. He's running away. He arrives at a well where he meets not one, but seven girls. Right? And then, of course, they don't, as I pointed out during the course of our reading, they don't invite him for a meal. Instead, they go home, and the father-in-law says, wait a second, go back and invite him for a meal. And then he's invited for a meal, and then he's given Tzipporah for a wife, and she is not from his family. Did you notice that, right? So there are some, I think, very very different features here. I'll mention one more thing, which I think is really very important, and that is that Moshe, at his betrothal scene, is busy saving people, right? He's busy fighting the great cause of justice. That's classic Moshe. And we just met him in this parak. But so far he's done two things in the parak. The first was to save a Jew from an Egyptian. The second was to save a Jew from a Jew. The third is to save a non-Jew from a non-Jew. Right? In other words, Moshe is an equal opportunity justice seeker. He doesn't care who it is. He wants justice. That's who Moshe is. That's why Moshe was chosen. Right? There's no doubt that God chooses Moshe because Moshe is looking for justice wherever he can. Now, one of the interesting things that we see in this parak is neatly divided into two. Parak Bet. The first half is the birth of Moshe. The key word in the first half of this parak is Yeled. It's mentioned seven times. Second half of the parak, Moshe's growing up. The key word is Ish. It's mentioned seven times. Okay? So we have the Yeled in the first part, the Ish in the second part. I would call this the maturation of Moshe. Moshe grows up. That's the second part of the parak. The Ish, however, interestingly enough, is not describing Moshe in this parak. We have the Ish Mitzri, we have the Shnei Anashim Nitzim. We have this this quest, I think, that Moshe is engaged in, a quest to find an Ish. He is looking for a role model, right? And the this point, I think, is beautifully made in the pasuk, which we're all familiar with, in which it says, Vayifen ko vacho, Vayar ki ein ish, right? And then, of course, he kills and buries the Mitzri. But I think I would read that in a more symbolic, in a deeper way. He looks around in Egyptian society. He sees there's no man, right? And Moshe is struggling, I think, with his own identity, which is why, of course, he is misidentified by the girls as an ish Mitzri. Moshe himself doesn't define himself. He's disappointed in the Mitzrim. He's disappointed in the Jews. He's now disappointed in all of society. He cannot find a man of justice until he meets Yitro. Vayoel Moshe Lashevet et Ha'ish. The Ish that Moshe finds is Yitro. And I want to make a radical suggestion here. I think that Moshe does not marry a girl. He marries a father-in-law. Moshe's legacy is not his children. It's not his continuation. He has a horizontal legacy. Moshe's legacy is the bringing of justice to the world. It's the chukim, it's the mishpatim. Who helps him to bring those chukot and chukim and torot and mishpatim to the world? The one who sets up his judicial infrastructure. Who's that? That's Yitro. Moshe's legacy is not about his children. His children don't continue him. Perhaps it's a tragic thing in Moshe's life. Certainly the Midrashim seem to think so. That's not present in the story. That's not evident in the story. He is looking for someone from whom he can learn justice. And that's why it's Yitro who invites him to a meal. Because Yitro is the one who understands how to interact properly. And this point, I think, is made amazingly by a midrash that is mentioned by the Abarbanel. The midrash itself actually appears in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, but the Abarbanel brings the midrash and then he explains the midrash and he explains it very beautifully. So I'll bring it in the name of the Abarbanel. The midrash says as follows. It's the sword and the stone. It's King Arthur, right? There was a tree, a stick, growing in Yitro's orchard. And everybody came and tried to uproot the stick, and no one was able to do so until Moshe came along and he walked out into Yitro's backyard and he effortlessly pulled out the stick. And that became the mateh of Moshe that he carried with him throughout his life. Now the Abarbanel says, what is the meaning of this midrash? I think it's an amazing midrash. It exactly encapsulates what I've been trying to say about Moshe. The stick, of course, is Yitro's knowledge, his wisdom, Moshe is the one who's able to release that wisdom on the world. By the same token, Moshe's wisdom is released by Yitro. It is a mutual partnership in which they work together in order to disseminate wisdom and justice in the world. And it's only when he finds Yitro that he finds the Ish. That's why he meets seven girls by the well. Sipora is an afterthought, right? He goes, he lives with the man. Oh, and then the man gives Sipora as a wife. She's an afterthought. Their relationship is not particularly developed. Of course, we have all sorts of problems with the relationship itself. We don't exactly know why Moshe sent her away, right? She's described as having been sent away by Moshe. We don't know why. There are endless exegetes and midrashim and try to deal with this question, but ultimately, of course, it's left without any explanation. We then, of course, have the story of Moshe and Aharon talking about, Miriam and Aharon talking about the Isha Kushit. Most of the Mefarshim there suggest that they're talking about the not very good relationship between Moshe and Tzipora. All of that is built on this story. And Moshe and Tzipora is not the crux of the matter. It's not the heart of the relationship. The heart of the relationship is one of the children of Reuel, one of the children of the man who is able to build the judicial infrastructure for Am Yisrael, and that's Moshe's legacy. All right, let's move on. I'm not going to talk about, there are other things to talk about. I think this ability, the idea that Moshe marries an outsider, it's very important, right? Moshe is the ultimate inside-outside person. Of course, he also is having a hard time identifying himself. Certainly in the beginning of the story, we have the famous Ibn Ezra in Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud, where the Ibn Ezra talks about why it's important that Moshe grew up in the Egyptian palace. Moshe has to maintain distance even while he integrates into the people, right? We see this also in Shmot Perek Lamed Gimel, where Moshe puts on the veil, right? There's a lot to say, and as I said, there's a lot to say about each of these scenes, but I'm going to move on ahead so that we actually are able to cover all of them, and you have a little bit of a sense of both the methodology and what we can do with it, how it can really enrich our understanding of these very familiar narratives. So there's, again, before we're able to see what in what way the text deviates from the type scene, we first have to define the type scene and be able to note the deviations, and that, of course, enables us to enrich our understanding of the story and the purpose of the story. All right, let's move on to our fourth type scene. Now, I didn't yet mention what that is, because as far as I think many of us are concerned, those three are the three major scenes. And yet, Robert Alter suggests that there is another scene here, and that is the story of Ruth and Boaz. Now, this story is a little bit interesting, because if you turn for a moment, for those of you who have full Tanakh and can find Ruth somewhat quickly, we have here in the story, of course, the story of Ruth and Boaz meeting in the field. The problem with identifying this story as a well story, of course, is that there's no well, right? And so we tend to miss the possibility that we have here a well scene. But that's not entirely true. There does actually seem to be a well. Yeah, where's the well?
It says,
Lishov, Yishavun. Very good. Perek Bet, Pasuk Tet. Right? When Boaz is speaking to Ruth, when he first meets her and she's standing there, he says to her, Perek Bet, Pasuk Tet, Einayich Basadeh, Asher Yitzarun, your eyes should be on that field where you are going to reap, V'halacht Acharehen, and you should go after the girls, Halotziviti et ha'ne'arim Livilti Nogeich, I have commanded the boys not to touch you. That itself, I think, is worthy of discussion, but clearly things that are going on in Beit Lechem Yehuda during the period of Shvot HaShoftim are not exactly appropriate. Vitzamit, and he says, and if you get thirsty, v'halacht el hakelim, you should go to the vessels, v'shatit me'asher yishavun hanarim, you should drink from that which the boys have drawn. The word lishov is a well word, okay? That is what is taking place in this scene. And think about it. Think about the features of the scene, which I tried to isolate for you at the beginning of this shiur. A man journeys from his home and goes to a distant land where he meets a nara next to the well. They are from the same family. She invites him to a meal and they are betrothed. It's the same story in reverse, It is the inverse story. A woman leaves her home in Moab and travels to a distant land where she meets a man and a nar, but also a man next to a well. They are from the same family. The whole story is about them being from the same family. Some sort of Yibum-like situation is going on here, and it's all about assuming halachic responsibility. That's what the story is about. Right? It's not about romantic interest. It's about halachic responsibility, which means that they're from the same family, which is because they're from the same family. And of course, he invites her to a meal, and they are betrothed. What does this tell us? What it tells us, I think, more than anything else, is that it is her legacy which we are seeking to perpetuate. She is the one who contains the characteristics that we are looking for in the Davidic dynasty. Boaz is never called by Chazal Abba Shel Malchut. It is Rut who is the Ima Shel Malchut. She is the mother of royalty. It is her traits which we are seeking to perpetuate. Again, I don't think that that I mean to say here that Boaz doesn't have complementary traits. And one of the things that we see in the Rut story is how deeply the traits of Rut, which we are looking to somehow implant into the lineage of the Davidic dynasty, are mirrored by Boaz. Of course, we have two people who do what we call chesed shel emet, right? Kindness that has no reciprocity, that there are no expectations of reciprocity. What is chesed shel emet? Chesed with the dead people. There are two people in the story who are described as people who do chesed shel emet. Of course, this is the type of chesed that we are looking for in the Davidic dynasty. The king who does kindness without any expectation of reciprocity is the ultimate king, because he is the only one whose power will not be corrupted. Because what happens the minute that a king starts to think about his own needs? There is no longer any justice. The king has all the power concentrated in his hands. It's only the king who's always thinking about doing for the other, about serving the people, who can limit his own inclinations to be corrupted by power. Of course, we have this trait in Rut. It's mirrored by Boaz. We have the trait in Rut in which she is a hardworking person. We see her min haboker v'ad ha'arev. She's from morning till night working in the field. Boaz, the wealthy landowner, working in the field, who's zoreh et goren ha'seorim balayla. He is threshing the barley at night. The oved, the ovedet, they get married, they have a child. What's his name? Oved, right? That's what we have. We have this story of two people who come together in service of the other, right? And it's Rut who actually personifies these kinds of traits which are necessary in creating the malchut. The protagonist of this betrothal scene is not the man in this particular case. It's the woman. That's one of the reasons, of course, that Megillat Rut is called Megillat Rut and not Megillat Boaz. This is the story of the perpetuation of the character traits of Rut, whose legacy, of course, is ultimately the Davidic dynasty. Okay, I want to take you to our last scene. This scene, actually, Chazal recognized is connected also to the other type scenes. In this scene, there is in fact a well, and therefore perhaps all of us should have immediately, you think well, and the alarm bells should start ringing, and you should go back to our previous well stories. Chazal do that, right? It's not just Robert Alter who notes that scene. Chazal compare three stories. They say, they actually formulate it a little bit differently. It's a midrash in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, and in this midrash, Chazal say, if ever you're on a journey and you see women going to the well, you should know that God has blessed your journey and that everything that you desire will come true. Where do we know this from? They bring three examples. One is Eved Avraham on his quest to find Rivka. A second is Moshe. And the third, anybody have an idea? Shaul. Good. Excellent. Let's look in Shmuel Aleph. Perek Tet. This is, I think, one of my favorite stories. I mean, it's just, I think, very alive. It's a very vibrant story. Of course, we know the story. The story is Shaul, who is you know, a nice homey boy. He likes to stay at home. He likes his family. And his father says, you know what? Our donkeys have gone missing.
take one of the servants and go and find the donkeys. Now he goes to find these donkeys, and of course he can't find the donkeys, but eventually he finds kingship, right? That's the story. But on his way to find these donkeys, he gives up at one point, right? He gives up. He says, I'm done. You know, if I continue looking, my father's going to worry about me. I need to go home. And the Na'ar, the servant who doesn't have a name, says, well, no, maybe we should go find the Navi, right? And the Navi will tell us. And Shaul says, find the Navi? I don't have any money. I don't have any bread. I don't have anything. So the Na'ar says, don't worry. I have all that stuff. Come with me. Right? So we see already the outset of the story that Shaul is a little bit floundering, and this anonymous boy is leading Shaul to where he needs to go. In any case, Shaul agrees, and he says, okay, fine, I'll go. Look in Pasuk Yud Aleph. I'm in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tet, Pasuk Yud Aleph. You know, let's start in Pasuk Yud. Vayomer Shaul Linaro. Shaul says to his boy, Tov Dvarcha, your word is good. Lecha Nelecha, let us go. Ve'achula Ir Asher Sham Ish HaElohim. So they go to the city where the man of God is there. Hema Olim B'Maleh HaIr. They are going up on the upward path to the city. Ve'hema Matzu Na'arot, and they find some girls. Yotzot Lishov Mayim. These girls are coming out to draw water. Ve'yomru Lahen, and they say to them, they say to the girls, Lahen, Hayesh Bazeh HaRo'eh, is the prophet here, is the seer here. Vatanena Otam Vatomarna. As I said, I think this is really one of my favorite psukim in Tanakh. I don't know if you're allowed to say that, but this is definitely one of my favorite psukim in Tanakh. Just listen, you don't even have to understand it, you already get a sense of what is going on in this pasuk. The girls answer and they say, Yesh, hine, lefanecha, maher, ata, ki hayom ba la'ir, ki zevach hayom la'am ba'bama, ki v'alachem ha'ir, ki intim tzu'un oto, b'ter mi'ala ba'ma t'alechol, ki lo yuchal ha'am ad bo'o, ki hu yivarech ha'zevach, acharechen yuchu ha'kruim, v'ata, alu, ki oto ki hayom tim tzu'un oto. Follow that? There's a lot of talking going on here. And really, the words are completely superfluous, and they're just, you know, sort of spilling out, and it's not exactly clear why they didn't just say yes, or you know, there's no yes in Tanakh, right? Of course, there's no word for yes in Tanakh. The word ken in Tanakh means truly. It doesn't mean, there's no word for yes. If you want to offer an affirmative answer to a question, you always repeat the word of the question. Hayesh bazeh ha-ro'eh, the correct response is yesh, right? That's the only response, and this, of course, is very wordy, and it's very overwhelming. And the Abarbanel has a great explanation here, where he says that all the girls were talking at once, right? And they're all talking together, and you hear it, and you really hear it when you read this pasuk. You can't even translate it, and you don't have to translate it, because the sense of the pasuk comes through loud and clear without the meaning of the words. Now, the Gemara in Brachot and Daf Memchet Amud Bet asks the question, Kol kach lama, like, why are they saying so much? Which is, I think, really what we're all thinking. Should I skip the first answer? I'll tell you the first answer. The first answer that I obviously completely disagree with is Lefisha Nashim Debraniotim. That's the first answer. Women are big talkers. That certainly is not true. Not that I haven't been speaking for the last hour, but the second answer of the Gemara, I think, is really what I'm looking for, which is the Gemara says, Lefisha, you mistaklot. Biyofyo shel Shaul v'lo hayu sveot mimenu. They were using a delay tactic. Shaul was very beautiful. Don't forget, he's of the Bnei Rachel. He has that charisma. He has that trait that draws people to him. And the women are going out to the well, and they recognize the betrothal scene, right? And they see this young man. He's gavoah mishichmo v'mala, gavoah mikol ha'am, right? He's very tall. He clearly has the bearings. He has the comportment of a king, even though he doesn't seem to be looking for kingship. The kingship is looking for him, and everybody who sees him seems to recognize this physical trait in him, and they don't want him to go. And so they're all talking over each other, which I think complements the Abarbanel's reading. Because in the reading of the Gemara, this is the delay tactic. In the reading of the Abarbanel, each girl is trying to draw Shaul's attention to her. Here, look at me, right? I'm the one who you need to choose in this betrothal scene. It's neither here nor there, because Shaul doesn't notice a thing. Right? Look at the next pasuk. Vayalu ha'ir. Okay. He just moves on. He misses his betrothal scene.
That's really what happens with Shaul. Shaul misses his betrothal scene. Now, there are some very, very interesting things that are going on here. I'll say maybe two of them. One interesting thing that has been pointed out by a woman named Ruth Paz in an article that she wrote for Megadim. I assume some of you are familiar with Megadim, which is the journal that is put out by Herzog College, where I teach. Some wonderful articles, especially using these kinds of literary techniques to mine the text for its theological message, have come out there. In, I believe it was number 8, Megadim Chet, she writes an article in which she describes a very interesting phenomenon that takes place here, and that is that Shaul is described in our initial meeting, and this again, first impressions matter, right? This is our first meeting with Shaul. There are three things that he doesn't have. He doesn't have donkeys, he doesn't have money, and he doesn't have women. What does that sound like? The three prohibitions on the king in Devarim, Perek Yud Zayin. Lo yarbelo nashim, lo yarbelo chesef zahav, lo yarbelo susim. It's a little bit of a stretch, but I think it works. The sus and the aton and the donkey are oftentimes placed in parallel. Not often, but every so often they are placed in parallel. She actually takes it a little bit in a different direction. What she wants to say is this presents Shaul as the ideal king. Look, he's the ideal king. He has none of the things that we're afraid are going to turn a king into a tyrant, into a corrupt king. I want to say the exact opposite. I want to suggest that the reason that we limit a king from having these three things is because the king is a person with ambitions. Only someone with ambitions is going to be a good king, a king that is successful, a king that can rally the people together and turn Am Yisrael into a force to contend with on the international scene. Shaul is not that person. Shaul is profoundly unambitious. Right? He's the one who, so the donkeys don't come home. Right? And that is the opposite of what we usually say about a king. Who's a king? A king is the good shepherd. The one like David, who when that lion came and took one little sheep from his flock, he fought the lion. He grabbed him by the beard and he killed that lion and he saved that one little sheep. Well, Shaul gives up on a whole flock. Right? And I think that is a consistent description of Shaul. The tragedy of Shaul is that he is chosen and forced to be king. He doesn't want to be king. He's not ambitious, not interested in money, not interested in donkeys, not interested in women. That's not what he's looking for, right? He just really wants to go home and be in the bosom of his own family. Shaul comes across, I think, as a very wonderful person, a very, I think, likable person in the beginning. He's, of course, dragged away from this and forced into a position of leadership. Perhaps that will be the subject of another shiur. But for the present, I think that what we're seeing here in the story of Shaul missing his betrothal scene is also part of that characterization of Shaul. I'll say one more thing, and that is that the betrothal scene actually isn't entirely cut off. Because, of course, Shaul is then invited for a meal. That's the end of the scene. But by whom? By Shmuel. This is a very elaborate meal that we have here, starting in Pasuk Kaf Bet. Vayikach Shmuel et Shaul, ve'et Naro, ve'yivim lishkata. The Shmuel takes both Shaul and his boy, vayitein lahem makom, berosh hakiruim, ve'hema kishloshim ish, and then he gives them the choicest piece of meat. This meal is very detailed, it's very elaborate. And perhaps one might suggest that, like we said about Moshe, Shaul's legacy is not dependent upon the women that he meets, but it's dependent upon his partnership with the Navi. And this is a point that I think is very, very important for understanding what happens later in the narrative. Ultimately, the partnership between Shaul and Shmuel is the critical partnership. And if Shaul relies entirely on the prophet in order to push him forward and to make his critical decisions, he would be successful. He could be successful. Of course, the moment in which the story begins to implode or to collapse around Shaul is the moment when he fails to listen to the prophet. And so the betrothal scene, on the one hand, you could suggest that it is sort of cut off or ignored. On the other hand, you could suggest that it actually takes a different direction and that it's not about his continuation, it's not about his legacy. In fact, Yonatan,
was doomed from the start, because it was never about Shaul's children. The success of his kingship was entirely 100% dependent upon his relationship with the Navi. And so that, I think, is another point that's made in the story. Okay, I'm going to close this shiur and just perhaps summarize and say, in addition to the fact that I think that what I've tried to show you is how we can really deepen our understanding of many different, very familiar stories simply by using this technique in order to really try to zone in on those particulars of the story which perhaps are being highlighted for us as the key points in each narrative. Also, I think one of the things that I was trying to show you is that literary techniques are not just an aesthetically pleasing pursuit, but rather when the Tanakh engages in any sort of or can be seen using any sort of literary technique, I think that we're meant to regard this as another way to deepen our understanding of the narrative, perhaps sometimes to more precisely characterize the biblical, the various persona, to accentuate, to understand in what way the Bible accentuates their role in the narrative. And it's my hope that in this shiur, I have demonstrated the effectiveness of the use of this particular literary technique, and perhaps also convinced you that many of these literary techniques, we can do the same with them in order to find deeper and more, I think, sharper theological messages, which is really what we're looking for. Thank you. That what? Moshe Aaron the Kanav, yeah. Yeah, but why? What are you trying to say? Oh, right. Yeah, well, Moshe and Shmuel are deeply connected. Hi. Oh, hello. How are you?
Thank you for the shiur.
My pleasure.
I heard your mother's voice speaking tonight.
Yeah.
And smiling.
Thank you.
I think I heard you in Ballykinwood many, many years ago, and you had the makings. So I'm so happy for you. How's your family?
Thank God. Everybody's good.
Good. I saw your father at a simcha back in May in Ballykinwood. He must have been in the States for a visit.
Yeah. And so, no, he's here half time. He's here half time, and he's there half time.
Okay, good. Good. And how big is your family?
I have 5 children.
Wonderful.
Thank God. Yeah.
Where is Malka living?
Malka's in Boston.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I hope I'll be privileged to hear you again in the future.
Thank
you. Do you come to the States at some
regularity? Pretty much every other year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So just for a short visit, not for extended teaching?
No, but a short visit. You know, I'm here for 2 weeks. That's pretty long.
And you hit a lot of cities?
That what?
Do you come to a lot of communities?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. I'll look forward to it.
All thank right. you.
I'll deal with it. It's
wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yaakov and what?
Struggles.
Yeah.
The two main points of the mother South Mountain.
Sarah, right.
First thing is to do to get the bottom finally the land.
Right, that's true. That's absolutely true.
Comes back, the land finally. It's got a pretty tiny boat, but then what happens?
He has to leave the land again.
He loses the sun, so it matters.
Right, and there they get fertility again, right? Right? Meaning there's that parallel.
Fertility is.
B'nai Yisrael paru vayishrutzu vayirbu
b'maod. No, I mean, B'chaim itself.
Yeah, the land fertility, but also the human fertility.
And if you get Hershey about it, it's broad. That's why there's the I in it. No, that's Hershey.
Yeah, okay. Enjoy the rest of the Super Bowl. Yes, absolutely. Sure.
Okay, sure. Well, I'll give you my email. I'll just say, again, I think the reason that Rivka was given such a big role is because Yitzchak has to be the opposite of that, and she needs to be in that supporting role. If she's not there, Yitzchak's blindness could lead the vision, you know, could lead Yitzchak off the path, which is exactly the story of Yaakov and Esav. She needs to be the background visionary to make sure that Yitzchak gets in. She's foreground, right, but it's not her legacy that we're looking to perpetuate. It's still, she's not one of the avot. She's not right. Yeah. Anyway, I'll give you my email address. It's yaelziegler@gmail.com. I'd be happy to hear from you. I won't be really checking my email very much for the next 2 weeks because I'm floating around. But yeah, sure, I'd love to hear from you.
I know.
Yeah.
But I love the way you
Thank you. Oh yeah, yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. All right, thank you. Hi. Oh really? Uh huh. Oh, okay.
You can listen to all the questions.